You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, has been involved in public life for more than 40 years. He served under Presidents Ford, Carter, and was President Clinton's Secretary of Labor. He's also a founding editor of the America Prospect magazine and chairman of Common Cause. And he's written 13 books. His latest work is an e-book exclusive, Beyond Outrage, What Has Gone Wrong with Our Economy and How to Fix It. It is published by Knopf. And it brings Robert Reich back to our show again. Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be here, Leonard.
You start by connecting the dots on seven conditions that have contributed to our current economic state. What are they?
Well, first of all, the extraordinary concentration of income and wealth at the top. It has been commented on a lot, but a lot of people don't see the relationship between that extraordinary concentration and a lot of other things that have happened. For example, the fact that tax rates on people at the very top have gone down at the same time as you get this big concentration of wealth. Well, that's not an accident, because with concentrated wealth at the top comes political power, no surprise. And with political power comes reducing tax rates, that ridiculous, for example, loophole that allows private equity managers to treat their incomes as capital gains. Mitt Romney has taken advantage of that. And then you see from there you can make you can understand why government revenues are substantially below what they would otherwise be if the middle class is not making money, and if all of the money is going to the top and the top have reduced their taxes. Well, obviously government is going to be squeezed. And in other words, what I try to do in the book is connect all those dots and show people a pattern that is developed.
Now, people who argue against what you're saying point out that if we raise the taxes, they say, on the wealthiest people, that we're punishing the job creators.
Well, the problem with that philosophy, to the extent it's a philosophy, I dignify it by saying it's a philosophy, is that before 1981, you know, the top marginal tax rate in this country was at least 70%, and that was from the 1940s right through 1981. Under Eisenhower, the top marginal tax rate was 91%. And even if you consider all of the deductions and the tax credits, the rich in this country were still paying about 56% of their income in taxes, that is, over a top marginal rate. We had a lot of different brackets at the top. Now, essentially, we have one big bracket captures everybody over about $350,000, no matter how much money they're making, and it's down to 35%. And if you are making most of your money, as Romney does and others, through capital gains, it's down to 15%.
Have we ever seen this level of accumulation of wealth before?
In the 1880s, 1890s, the era of the robber barons, the Gilded Age. By some measures, Leonard, in the 1920s, we also saw this concentration of income and wealth.
You talk about it in the lead-up to the Great Depression.
In lead-up to the Great Depression. In fact, it's not an accident that in 1928 and in 2007, we have the two peak years in terms of the amount of total national income going to the top 1%, because both of those peak years, 1928 and 2007, were the years just before great crashes. The great crash of 1929 was bigger than the crash of 2008, but they're related in the sense that you know, the middle class just doesn't have the wherewithal, the purchasing power to keep the economy going, other than going deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, and those debt bubbles eventually burst, a la 1929 and 2008.
And you pointed out recently, rich Americans spend a much smaller portion of their incomes than does the vast middle class. Their marginal satisfaction from additional spending falls off. The second yacht isn't nearly as much fun as the first. So the middle class is what really drives the economy, and they've been squeezed, you're saying?
Yes, the middle class drives the economy.
I could say
the
we've
spending
been
of the middle class drives the economy. And we're not talking only here. When I'm talking about spending, I don't only mean the accumulation of stuff. I mean, it's non-material goods, and it doesn't only have to be private spending. It can be public spending on education or making the environment cleaner, infrastructure. But unless we have all of that spending that puts people to work, what we end up having, and we have it in spades right now, is an economy that is sluggish. It's barely growing. Austerity economics doesn't work. We see it in Europe. It's been a tragic failure there. And if you have high unemployment, as we do now, and underutilized capacity, as we do now, and widening inequality, as we do now, if government then cuts its budget on top of everything else, you are creating a kind of crisis on the demand side of the economy. There's just not enough demand for the goods and services the economy could produce at full employment.
And we had two elections this weekend in which austerity was rejected by the voters in France and Greece. But what does that ultimately mean? And would something similar happen in this country?
Well, it, as a practical matter, in Europe, it doesn't mean that they are going to stop worrying about their budgets. They can't afford to do that because international lenders are not going to continue to provide them with money unless they do something about their budget deficits. But it does mean that they will probably slow down their budget cutting. They will modify and negotiate with international creditors to modify the bailout from the IMF and other international loans. The social costs, the human costs of austerity economics has been so great in places like Greece, but also in France and elsewhere, that the people are simply rejecting it.
Although it has also led to the rise of, in both countries, popularity of far-right parties.
And, yes. And this
parties
is something
that
else.
Are very sympathetic to the Nazis of the past.
And far-left parties. I mean, you have in Greece a new alliance of the left and the right. In France, the right is resurgent, but so is the left, the socialists. What you see around the world where austerity economics has been tried, where you have high unemployment, slow growth, and austerity, that is, severe cuts in budget deficits, is you have more extreme politics. And the United States is not immune, Leonard. I mean, you see a shadow of that here.
So how do we increase demand through fiscal policy?
Well, very, very easy. You set targets for unemployment and for growth. In this country, you say, okay, we're not going to really begin serious deficit cutting until we get unemployment down to 6% and until we have at least two quarters of growth in excess of 3%
growth. We seem to be stuck around 8% now.
And now it's stuck around 8%. But what those targets do, they send a very clear signal to the public and to markets that you're serious about deficit reduction, but you're not going to do it at the expense of employment and growth. You're not going to go into a kind of an austerity trap, which is what happened in Europe. Because remember, the real goal is not just to cut the public debt or the public deficit. The goal is to cut the public debt or deficit as a proportion of total national economy. So if what your policies end up doing is slowing growth or actually creating a recession, a contraction in the economy, you are left with the worst of all worlds.
And you just wrote in, is it your blog that I just read? The underlying problem is structural. It's been growing for decades. A structural problem of stagnant or declining real incomes for most people and soaring income and wealth at the top was masked during the boom years when the middle class could turn their homes into piggy banks and extract home equity loans or refinance. But the mask came off in 2008 as home values plummeted.
And we can't put the mask back on. And so that the answer certainly is not supply-side trickle-down economics. I mean, giving tax breaks to the rich or to corporations is going to have no positive effect whatsoever because they already have as much money as they can possibly use. Big corporations are now sitting on almost $2 trillion of cash. But nor is the answer necessarily going to be found in more Keynesian stimulus, because you just can't keep on stimulating the economy in the hopes that eventually the middle class is going to have enough money to turn around and buy things, because the wage structure has now essentially collapsed.
So Keynes only works when there's fairer wage structure?
Exactly. Keynes only works when you have a relatively modest degree of inequality. That is the kind of inequality that we had between the 1940s and the 1970s. When you lurch toward the kind of inequality we now have, Keynes is not enough.
My guest is Robert Reich, whose latest book is an e-book. We'll find out why he's chosen to publish it that way, from Knopf. It's called Beyond Outrage, What Has Gone Wrong with Our Economy and How to Fix It. Stay with us for more. We're back with Robert Reich, whose latest book, your 14th or your 13th?
I think 13th, but it could be 14th.
But it's unlike the other books because it's an e-book from Knopf. It's called Beyond Outrage, What Has Gone Wrong with Our Economy and How to Fix It. And why did you decide to publish this as an e-book?
Well, first of all, I wanted to be very current. Normal publishing takes 8 or 9 months from the time a manuscript is delivered until you get it out the door. Secondly, I wanted it to be inexpensive. This is only $2.99. I mean, and if you want videos that I put in it, there's another edition for $3.99. But I wanted it to be current, topical, and I wanted it to be very accessible to a lot of people.
But people without access to certain technologies won't be able to read it.
Yes. And so there is a generational element to this. I mean, my students are reading my stuff, and they have iPads and tablets of various sorts. So they have no trouble. But quite frankly, people my age, the technology is different. I mean, they like books. I have to confess, I like real books too. In fact, this may come out as a paperback.
But you are obviously reaching out to younger people. You dedicate the book to the occupiers.
Yes, and to anyone who's trying to take back our economy and regain our democracy.
Well, the latest issue of N+1 has called the Occupy movement our last best hope. Do you see that?
I don't think it's our last best hope. I mean, the Occupy movement is kind of an amorphous group of people, and I've talked to many of them, and I've been at many rallies that are very concerned about the things that I think people ought to be concerned about, and that is not only the extraordinary concentration of income and wealth, but the extraordinary concentration of political power that comes as a consequence of that. So we're losing our democracy.
But critics of Occupy Wall Street have said that it isn't structured to affect real change. Well, unlike the Tea Party, which mobilizes voters to vote for certain candidates, this is something quite different.
Well, I say to any critics who say we want more, well, go ahead and do it. I mean, a lot of people these days, particularly on the progressive side of the ledger, complain. Deal. They say, well, we don't like Obama as too much of a compromiser, or there's not enough action, or there's not enough of a progressive agenda. And I look back in their eyes, to the extent that I can, I'm usually much shorter than they are, and I say, well, what are you doing about it? I mean, this is, democracy is to be practiced. It's not to be talked about. And for too long, we think the whole agenda is electing the right person and then walking away, when in fact, once the person is elected who we want to be elected, that's the beginning. As Franklin D. Roosevelt once said, I think it was the election of 1936, when somebody came up and said, Mr. President, if you're reelected, we want you to do this and this and this. He said, I would love to, but you must make me. And that's what democracy is about, Leonard. We forget. Good people can be in Washington, but unless good people outside Washington are mobilized and energized and organized to make things happen in Washington, to push good people in Washington, nothing good is going to happen.
A listener, David in Manhattan, wrote in, I think super wealthy people and corporations understand a lot of what Mr. Reich is saying. I just think they don't care. You've proposed a corporate pledge of allegiance.
I think, well, first of all, to deal with what the listener just said, I think they individually do care. Some of them care very much. I mean, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and others have lent their names and quite a considerable amount of time to the cause of raising taxes on the wealthy. But I think there's a more basic point here. This is not a zero-sum game in which if the wealthy are taxed more somehow, that means that other people are going to do better or worse. It's a positive-sum game. The wealthy in this country would actually do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy in a society that was not so divisive than they are doing right now with a very large share of an economy that's almost dead in the water and a society that is incredibly polarized.
Now, another listener, Merritt from New York City, asks, why didn't President Clinton fight against the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which separated commercial from investment banking?
That's a good question. I was unfortunately no longer in the administration when that decision was made. I thought it was a terrible decision. In fact, we're not going to really control Wall Street until Glass-Steagall is resurrected. The Volcker Rule, kind of Glass-Steagall light, has proven itself to be completely ineffective. The latest version I saw is, it's so chock full of holes. You know, it looks like Swiss cheese. It's just the entire rule has been eviscerated by lobbyists and lawyers for Wall Street. No, we've got to go back to Glass-Steagall.
16.4% of the people under the age of 25 are unemployed. Some of them are also facing huge student loan debt. Big businesses routinely file for bankruptcy. Why can't young people use bankruptcy to reorganize their loans?
They should be able to. First home buyers, that is, if you have a first home, you have a mortgage, you're underwater, and students with debt, those are two groups that are not permitted to file for bankruptcy with regard to those kinds of debts.
Because of a law that was passed during the Clinton administration?
Well, it's actually three laws that were passed, one during the Clinton administration and two before that. They were passed because the bankers were very powerful, are very powerful. But as a result, it's made it terribly difficult for families, for students. But at the same time, what do you have? You have American Airlines reorganizing under bankruptcy, abrogating all its union contracts. Actually, its original intention was to get rid of its pension plans and put them on the back of taxpayers. So we have, once again, one set of rules for the corporations and for the very wealthy. You can use bankruptcy. But when it comes to student debt or people who are underwater with their first homes, you can use bankruptcy on your second home. It's just not your first home.
Now, last week, the House passed a bill to maintain the interest rate on student loans at 3.4%. But isn't there still a possibility that next year interest rates will double? What kind of impact would that have on the huge numbers of student loans that might default?
Well, to the extent that the student loans are variable rate loans, and some private lenders do provide student loans that are variable, that will rise if interest rates rise and if we have a lot of inflation, it's going to be terribly difficult. But it's difficult as it is, Leonard, because you've right now college graduates. The rate of unemployment among college graduates is about 6.3%. It's not 8.1%. That's the national unemployment rate. But it is higher than the rate for college graduates overall. Recent college graduates are having a hard time getting jobs. And they are burdened. The typical college graduate has $25,000 at least of loan. They can't get rid of it. They can't reorganize it under bankruptcy. They can't extend the terms. They can't find a job. Well, this is a recipe for real, real hardship.
My guest is Robert Reich, who's served under three presidents and now is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. His most recent book, an e-book, is called Beyond Outrage, What Has Gone Wrong with Our Economy and How to Fix It. In Friday's jobs report for April, unemployment dipped to 8.1% and only 115,000 jobs were added last month. You've said that we've got to add 250,000 jobs every month. Is that even possible? Is that realistic?
Under certain circumstances, it is realistic.
And then Mitt Romney said it should be 500,000 jobs.
Mitt Romney doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, look, the best job creation we've had was in the late 1990s. I won't add that that was when I was Labor Secretary, and it obviously had nothing to do with it. A president and administration can at most set the conditions, but it is the private sector that creates jobs. But that was about 350,000 a month. We did get unemployment down to 4% for a period of time. But how did Bill Clinton do that? How did we, to the extent that the administration had any role at all? We did the opposite of what Mitt Romney and also Paul Ryan and the Republicans are demanding. We actually raised taxes on the rich. We invested in education and infrastructure. We expanded something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is basically a wage subsidy for the working poor. We created the conditions under which it was possible for a lot of people to have more buying power in this society. And that buying power translated into more jobs. If you look only at the supply side of the equation and say, well, it's all about incentives for rich people to create more jobs or for corporations to create more jobs, you miss the essence of the economy. They're not going to do that if there are not customers for all the additional capacity that we want them to create.
In 2010, General Electric, it's been reported, made $5.1 billion from its operations in the United States, yet paid absolutely nothing in taxes, even claimed $3.2 billion in tax benefits. As they point out, this is perfectly legal under the current laws. But why isn't that creating more jobs? Where's that money going to? Are these corporations putting them in the bank? Or is it all about spending it on super PACs to affect the next election?
No, these corporations are sitting on almost $2 trillion of cash. They are using it to buy back their stock in an effort to raise the value of their stock. They are using some of the money to automate, to get rid of jobs, basically substituting software. They're using some of the money to expand operations abroad, where there are a lot of consumers out there in Asia and elsewhere. But they are not using the money to expand here in the United States because they're not adequate customers. They're not enough people. You know, this is not rocket science. If Americans are not earning because the median wage keeps on dropping and because unemployment is at very high levels. In fact, the percentage of the working age population who's actually employed is now down to what it was in 1981. Well, then people cannot turn around and buy stuff. And if they can't turn around and buy stuff, employers are not going to create more jobs.
In The Work of Nations, a book you published 21 years ago in 1991, you said that the U.S. was heading toward a skills gap that would divide the country. Has that happened?
To some extent, it has. And to some extent, it is responsible for some of the widening inequality. But the kind of inequality we have seen over the last 10 years really is less skills related than it is related to a fairly narrow elite. People who are private equity managers and hedge fund managers, financiers on Wall Street in general, CEOs, some very talented people in the entertainment industry. This very small group really is taking the lion's share of most of the income. It's less skills-based than it is being at the right place at the right time with the right connections. You know, the 400 wealthiest families in this country now have more than the bottom 150 million Americans put together.
But you criticize the super rich for being able to write off their charitable donations to the arts. You say these aren't real charities. They're investments in the lifestyle the wealthy already enjoy. Doesn't supporting the arts raise the quality of life in society? Are you saying that we shouldn't encourage support for museums, concert halls, operas, dance companies, public broadcasting?
Public radio?
Yeah.
No. I'm saying that to call it a charitable contribution and to pretend that it's all about providing money to the poor and to for charitable causes stretches the meaning of charity. I mean, I don't have any objection to people who are very rich donating to culture palaces and to their alma maters as if Harvard needed any more money. But then
they can put their name on the building.
They can put their name on buildings. They can get a lot of indirect glory. But what I do object to is the very easy, glib use by many people of the notion that, well, I give to charity and therefore we don't need government services, we don't need safety nets, we don't need – well, that's just baloney.
What do you say to those people who claim that the corporate taxes in this country are the highest in the world?
I say they – as a matter of fact, when you consider all of the tax dodges that are perfectly legal, the effective tax rate for corporations is about the same as what it is in Europe and comparable nations.
Especially if you have a good accountant.
If you have a good accountant, then you're like GE and you pay no taxes at all.
Does any of this matter as far as the election is concerned until after Labor Day?
Probably not, Leonard. I mean, the public is not paying much attention. They do pay attention after Labor Day. The only thing that's going to happen between
now— So the president
now,
has to hope that the unemployment rate goes down a little bit.
That's right.
And Republicans have to hope that it doesn't.
Well, unfortunately, that's what I believe that they are hoping. And I do also believe that one reason they haven't given the president any help along the way in terms of providing a larger payroll tax deduction, unemployment benefits, all the things that he's asked for, is that maybe, and I hope I don't sound too cynical to listeners, but maybe they wouldn't mind if the unemployment rate was fairly high and the economy was in a second double dip by Election Day, because that would mean that people will say essentially what they said to George Bush, and they said to Jimmy Carter, you can't deliver, we're getting rid of you.
Beyond Outrage, What Has Gone Wrong with Our Economy and How to Fix It is published by Knopp. My great thanks to Robert Reich for being a guest again on our show.
Good to see you again, Leonard. Thank you.